Hi, I'm Stephanie Shelton, and this is Conversations on Health, How We Get There, episode 20. Now, this may surprise you with all the medical advances we've made in the last decade or so, but heart disease remains the leading cause of death in the United States as it has been since 1921. A recent poll conducted for the American Heart Association found 51% of respondents had no idea. According to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, one person dies every 33 seconds in the United States from cardiovascular disease. Think about that. One person every 33 seconds. And this may also surprise you. The CDC says that in 2019, which is the last year it has the numbers for, heart disease cost the U.S. about $240 billion. Think about the inflation you've just experienced over the last couple of years, and you can get an idea of what that number is going to be like for 2024. One reason for the growing cost of heart disease is that most of it is treatable now. And as the huge boomer cohort turns into the senior class, older people with heart disease are living longer. So I thought it would be interesting to talk to a heart specialist that I know who would likely have been doing something else just 30 or 40 years ago. Dr. Mohammed Ali Habibi is an electrophysiologist with the highly rated Valley Health System and Hospital in New Jersey. Valley's state-of-the-art new hospital just opened, and Valley is also partnered with the country's top-ranking heart hospital, the Cleveland Clinic. Ali, thank you so much for giving us some time today and coming on the podcast.
Well, thank you for having me.
Let me just kind of start out at the beginning, because I certainly didn't know what an electrophysiologist was until I met you. And tell me exactly what you do.
So an electrophysiologist is a cardiologist, basically. But we take care of people with abnormal rhythms of the heart, either slow heart rate or fast heart rate or irregular heart rate. So we are dealing with electrical abnormalities of the heart. So the heart is an organ in the body that pumps the blood, has blood vessels, has valves, but also has electrical system that regulates the heart rate, regulates the rhythm. So whenever you have abnormal rhythm, or it can be either slow, fast, irregular, then that's going to be a problem. And we deal with those issues of the heart. And in order to be an electrophysiologist, basically you go to med school. Once you finish the med school, usually you have to do internal medicine residency. Once you're an internal medicine internist, basically, then you do cardiology, and then you go for electrophysiology. So it needs several years of training to become an electrophysiologist.
And it didn't even exist like 25 years ago.
It existed 25 years ago, but in terms of modern electrophysiology, probably goes from in 80s, we started in terms of, if you want to do the procedures in electrophysiology, started around in 80s, they started doing ablation procedures, that's what we do these days. In the past, it was basically just putting devices such as pacemakers that electrophysiologists would do. But in modern electrophysiology, that is not older than 30, 40 years now.
That's right? Just amazing. Right. I think I read in doing the research for this that Medicare and Medicaid, the United States, didn't certify electrophysiologists as a separate specialty or subspecialty of cardiology until something like 2011.
Correct. So the conditions that, I mean, could have, can be treated by an electrophysiologist were not as many, except many years. We didn't have the knowledge, we didn't have the equipment, required equipment to treat those conditions. But nowadays, with the advanced in medicine, advanced in the equipments and technology, we are able to offer patients with those kind of disease the several options for treatment. So it's getting, as medicine in general, becoming more subspecialized in all areas, same as cardiology. So we have now a general cardiologist, we have an electrophysiologist, we have an interventionist, we have a structural heart disease, we have an adult congenital heart specialty, we have specialties that just take care of people who are on chemotherapy, for example, develop heart disease. So like any other area in medicine, cardiology also becoming much more subspecialized.
And yet, when you look at the figures, heart disease is still the number one killer, has been for 100 years in the mm-hmm. United States. And something like one out of every five deaths, one death every 33 minutes, these are the figures that came from the federal government, have to do with heart disease. That to me is amazing, because everything you've talked about says advance, 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 and then you come back to this has basically not changed that much.
Sure.
Does it have to do with us as modern Americans, mm-hmm. for example, and I won't talk about the rest of the world, just what I know somewhat, you know, is it the growing rate of obesity? Is it diet, lifestyle, something else?
See, I think all of the above. As the population is getting older, because in like maybe 50, 60 years ago or 100 years ago, people used to die from infectious disease. But now we can treat those conditions, and as the population becoming older, as we are less physically active, we become more obese. Obesity is becoming a pandemic, which is the biggest risk factor for a cardiovascular disease, for even for arrhythmias of the heart, such as atrial fibrillation, for example. So we have more heart disease, and then we diagnose them more often, and still number one cause for mortality is heart. Even for during the COVID year, the cardiovascular disease was number one cause for mortality in the United States, right?
It's just amazing.
So that's why the most important part to prevent that is to preventive cardiology.
Yeah.
So that's, I think we should invest more in prevention rather than treatment, because that's going to be much more cost effective rather than just treating each condition. We should invest more as a society in preventive healthcare.
Well, that's kind of leading into the question about Wegovy, Novo Nordisk's Wegovy, and some of the other obesity drugs now. Wegovy being the latest one that has been certified as helpful for either preventing or helping people with heart disease who are obese. Do we do it that way? Do we do it by changing lifestyles? Do you prescribe a drug, or does the cardiologist further down the list, not the specialty cardiologist, prescribe it? And this is the big argument in society, do we take this pill and give it to everybody who is major league overweight and say it's an easy way out and you'll be healthier, or do we go back or keep what a lot of healthy athletic people think we should keep, which is diet and exercise?
Yeah, of course, the easiest or the more doable way is diet and exercise. You cannot prescribe every single obese person a medication, and all these medications have side effects, and we still don't know the long-term outcome of it. Although the initial results from GLP-1 medications such as Wegovy is very promising, we still don't know what happens when they stop these medications, whether they regain the weight back, or we still don't know how to take them off of these medications. This approach, although it's successful, and I personally prescribe these medications for people who are obese. I do, yes. For people who are obese and they have other arrhythmias, they refer to me for such as atrial fibrillation, because the biggest, one of the most common risk factors for AFib is obesity. So when I see someone who is obese and has atrial fibrillation, I do prescribe those medications, especially if they have failed routine weight loss programs in the past. But first of all, they are expensive, and some insurances don't cover it. And also, it's hard to, even if you have insurance coverage, it's not available. So it's because the demand is so high, you cannot easily find it. So still, I think the best strategy is exercise, diet, and change of lifestyle. And that basically should start from when you're younger and earlier stages of life.
Do you ever get to this point with your, because you don't see a patient until they have it already.
Correct.
They're already ill. They already have a heart issue or atrial fibrillation or one of the other electrical aberrations. So do you actually ever get into that kind of a discussion with a big question that I've always asked all my life, how did you let yourself get to that point?
You mean get to the point
of
that,
obesity.
So that's why, again, we should invest more on prevention, right? So the time that I see those patients, I'm not a primary care physician.
Right.
I'm not a preventive cardiologist.
But you are an internist.
Correct.
I mean, which
correct.
Is kind of like my primary care physician is an internist.
Right. True. Correct. But I don't practice as an internist.
Yeah.
So my main... basically patients that I see are people with arrhythmias who are referred to me by internists, by cardiologists. But I think the main job of our healthcare system should be focusing on the prevention rather than treatment. So that would be more cost effective and more doable for long term.
You trained at some of the big major teaching hospitals in big cities like New York and I think Baltimore. And then, you know, you told me how long it takes and how much effort there is to get to the point where you are actually able to get a job on your own.
Right.
And then you came out to Valley. What was your reasoning?
So I was looking for a job in New York area because my wife had a job in New York City, so that was number one. But I was also impressed by the way the Valley Health System treats patients, and also the way it is not it's a community hospital, but the amount of focus that they have here, especially the cardiovascular team here, has on research and doing clinical trials. To let you know, in 2023, Valley Hospital, we had around 21 papers published from just Valley Hospital.
Ah.
We have enrolled more than 260 patients in clinical trials. We have more than 40 active clinical trials just in the cardiovascular line. And we started 16 new clinical trials just last year in 2023. So that was the part that I was impressed with. Because of all those, as an electrophysiology group, we were exposed to new technology that is not available in some big academic centers. So, for example, FDA approved pulse field ablation, which is a type of ablation for arrhythmias. Ablation means we go into the heart, you find the source of arrhythmia or irregular rhythm,
yes.
And you burn in the heart. So there are different types of different methods of burning in the heart.
But the newest, like hot and cold.
That is correct. So we call it thermal ablation. You either freeze it or you burn it with the radio frequency. So the new technology, which is pulse field, it just became available in U.S. FDA approved last month in February, and we were one of the first three hospitals in Northeast that have it access to it. And maybe the first one in New Jersey. So because of those reasons, that was the biggest one that made me think the Valley is a good fit for me to work with.
My sense, having lived in both places, New York City and out here, and I'm from Boston, which is a major medical center, is that some, and my own personal hospital experiences, is that sometimes a smaller system, you as a patient get more attention, and that the people you deal with, not just at the doctor level, but you know, down to the person who cleans your room, are just kinder, nicer somehow.
It's more personal connections, I think, in smaller hospital than big university places. Not that, I mean, I don't know, for some people, some conditions might be those are more advanced care might be needed, but even for that, I don't see, I mean, I was at Johns Hopkins, which is one of the biggest hospitals in U.S., so I don't see any, at least in adult cardiovascular disease, I don't see any condition that, any treatment options that we had there that we don't have it here. I mean, we don't have heart transplant at Valley, but other than that, there is no other condition that I can see we used to offer there that we cannot offer here. there are many.
What about the alliance with the Cleveland Clinic? Because it's something even I know about it. I have read about, you know, the what is publicized about it, but even I don't really understand it.
So basically, it is when you have an alliance with the Cleveland Clinic, they monitor or they review your outcomes in terms of doing the procedures, for example, to make sure you're doing based on their guidelines or based on the guidelines in medicine, and make sure you're doing the right way, and make sure your outcomes are in line with their outcomes. So, and they do review our procedures quite often, and then they find it in line with their goals and their outcomes, basically.
Would you ever, in a really difficult case, bring in somebody from Cleveland Clinic, or do you just suggest that they go talk to somebody?
It hasn't happened, but we have an option of consulting them for difficult cases. You can send records, and they have someone who can consult you. And in case of something that you have questions on the approach, on what to do, but it hasn't happened to us that someone comes in. And but you can, of course, consult them, and they're available to help.
All right, so we've been to some extent talking about now. Mm-hmm. Let's talk about tomorrow and the future. I mean, I didn't ask you this. Why did you choose electrophysiology?
The reason I chose electrophysiology, the main one, is I was fascinated by the thought process of electrophysiology. When you're dealing with arrhythmias, the thought process behind it and the diagnosis, basically. In medical school, I was fascinated by reading EKGs. So then, and there's cardiology. When you do cardiology, you do rotations and different parts of the general cardiology subspecialties. Okay. And I was fascinated by the thought process behind diagnosing different arrhythmias and the involvement of the technology in how you can immediately change someone's life by doing a procedure, or whether it's a medication or putting a device or doing an ablation, and how much impact it can have on someone's life. And it's a procedural base, and I personally like doing procedures.
So it's a combination of essentially diagnosis.
Correct.
And equipment or a facility and knowing how to use
Correct.
That. But a lot of it is the doctor.
Of course, like any subspecialty or any specialty, the doctor plays a significant role in subspecialty.
There's something on the Cleveland Clinic's website. I wrote it down here if I can actually find it. It says, an electrophysiologist can figure out what's happening in your heart's electrical or with your heart's electrical impulses and fix it. But you can't always fix it.
With advances in technology, the outcome of electrophysiology procedures improving significantly. You cannot always fix it, but there is a good chance that you can fix most of the arrhythmias of the heart. And even if you cannot fix it, you can improve, do things to improve quality of life of patients with arrhythmias. And you can improve their life expectancy. Some of these procedures that we do safely these days were not available 20 years ago or 25 mm-hmm. years ago. So there's a good chance that if you have an arrhythmia that is fixable, either it could be with a medication or just monitoring or sometimes just putting a device in the body or sometimes doing an ablation procedure. So you have a high chance for fixing all those problems.
So looking ahead, what is most exciting to you? Because I'm sure, like all other aspects of medicine, electrophysiology is essentially exploding.
Correct. So the most exciting part, I think, in electrophysiology, same as all other aspects of medicine, is artificial intelligence. Wherever you have a lot of data, and then that's where you can use AI or artificial intelligence. That could be used or is being used in diagnosis, in risk stratification of patients, for example, finding the right person for the right treatment, and then then to predicting the outcome of that type of procedure or outcome of that patient at that individual. Or you can use it to individualize the treatment plan. So for example, you may not have need the same procedure, same treatment plan as someone else. So you can use AI to improve those, to individualize the treatment plan and also to monitor patients. So I think we are all in an excited era of medicine or life. So I think I'm sure gonna change a lot in several in next few years with the use of AI. And we're gonna hear much more in future.
I read something to the effect, not just AI, but AR, augmented reality.
Correct.
What would you use that for?
It's interesting you ask that because we just started for augmented reality, for example, we just started doing our procedures at Valley. There is a system that there's one of these glasses, like the 3D glasses
really?
That you put on while you're doing procedure. You can have a 3D shell of the heart in front of you, and with just movement of your eye, you can zoom in, zoom out, go inside and come out. So that's why I found all those very exciting. And I'm sure with the advance in technology in just not maybe a year or two, we're so close to have the AI or augmented reality deep embedded into electrophysiology procedures.
Do you ever envision a time, I mean, this scares the hell out of writers and reporters, and they can already clone our voices. Do you ever envision a time when the AIs and the augmented realities will be so good that basically you can kind of set it up and let it go? No doctor?
I don't think so, but I don't think doctors would go away. I don't think AI could be, at least I can't see it in early future that AI could replace doctors. But I think doctors who don't use AI will be replaced by doctors who use AI, right? That I think I'm sure gonna happen. Right?
So right. The next generation of doctors who come along, your medical training is going to involve technology courses.
Of course, yeah, right. It's going to be much more different than like 10 years ago, the way you're going to train the new doctors in the future.
Right. You talked about this a little. Most doctors are like, okay, I'm here to help you as a doctor, and how you got to me is not really what I'm most interested in, and I assume you have insurance because you've been allowed in the building.
Right.
But there are a lot of people who don't have insurance, don't have much insurance, are afraid of doctors, don't have any regular care, and end up in the emergency room when it's almost too late. Do you ever think that way as what kind of a doctor are you? The one who looks at those people and says we need to, and say, you're saying we need to help them also?
Yeah.
Or you're just, I'm a doctor, I'm here to do my job, and that's what I do?
That's a very good question. I think everyone is entitled to have access to healthcare. And the healthcare should be affordable for every citizen, so especially sick people. It happens a lot of time that you see people who need a specific, especially as an outpatient, because inpatient, everyone gets treatment. So when you come to the emergency room and then you don't have health insurance and you need a procedure or you need a service that required to save your life, you're going to get it. So no matter you have insurance or no matter you don't have health insurance. But in outpatient setting, sometimes it's painful to see someone who needs a specific treatment and the treatment is available and you know that it can help them, but you cannot offer it because of lack of insurance, because of the high expense of the healthcare.
Yeah.
So that is really painful to see, but we are practicing in an area that in a neighborhood that most people do have insurance, but the time that you see those people who cannot access healthcare because of that issue is really painful to see.
And they're further advanced in whatever's wrong with them because they don't have regular medical care.
That is correct.
Where it could be caught at the beginning.
Correct. That is correct.
And that's kind of universal healthcare, which we don't have in this country, the only country that I know of in the developed world that does not have it.
That is correct.
And it's also because outreach is so expensive. And it's good to hear that you look outside of, because it's real easy to be in your own little box, you know, you're working and doing and saving lives and looking outside.
Yeah.
Ali, thank you.
Thank you very much.
Really a great interview.
Thank you very much.
Thanks for coming on the podcast.
Of course.
Dr. Muhammad Ali Habibi is an electrophysiologist with a highly rated Valley Health System and Hospital in New Jersey. A week or so after we recorded our conversation, Medicare and Medicaid decided that their drug plans can now pay for Wegovy and later other anti-obesity drugs approved for cardiovascular benefits by the FDA. The drug must be prescribed for patients who already have cardiovascular disease and only for reducing the patient's risk of heart attack and stroke. Now, how many times have we all said, when will they find a cure for cancer? Of course, there is no one cure, any more than there is just one type of cancer. But there have been great strides in recent years, and you'll learn all about them and more in our next episode, and that would be number 21. My guest will be Dr. Theodore Lawrence, who has a medical practice, is a professor of radiation oncology at the University of Michigan, and is actively researching better treatment outcomes for gastrointestinal and central nervous system cancer. He's really excited about what he's doing and discovering, and I think you will be too. I schedule one new podcast episode a month, so look for the next episode in May. And the drop day is usually the third Tuesday of every month. Updates on my show notes on my podcast page. I'd really, really, really appreciate it if you'd subscribe and if you would rate us or just leave us a review wherever you listen or watch your podcasts. We're on Apple, YouTube Music, Spotify, TuneIn, Amazon Music, iHeart, Podchaser, and my host platform, the Podbeam app. The video version is on YouTube. Show notes and links on my website, www.stephanieshelton.com/conversations. If you like the podcast, it would really, really be a help if you would just share it. Okay? I'm Stephanie Shelton, and until we meet again, please take care of yourself and all those you love. Conversations on Health, How We Get There is produced and edited by Frank Harold. Research assistance from Dr. Richard Saltman, Professor Emeritus of Health Policy and Management, Rollins School of Public Health at Emory University in Atlanta.